Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to give a talk in this very, very beautiful room. I'm very excited to tell you about some recent work I did with Rafael Busso, a series of three papers in which, as you might have guessed from the title, we prove a new area law in general relativity. And we also formulate a semi-classical generalization, a generalized second law. Now, we already have an area law in GR. We've had it since 1971, the Hawking area theorem, which tells us that the area of the event horizon increases as we evolve forward in time. And we associate to the event horizon an entropy, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is proportional to the area of the event horizon. This gives us a way of also formulating a semi-classical generalization, Bekenstein's generalized second law, which tells us that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy plus the entanglement entropy outside the black hole increases as we evolve forward in time. And this is, of course, a very useful, very fruitful formulation of black hole thermodynamics and has given rise to a lot of research. But nothing is perfect, and this formulation does have a couple of drawbacks, which are rooted in the definition of the event horizon. The event horizon is defined as the boundary of the past of future infinity. So it's the entire future history of the space-time that you have to take into account when you're defining the event horizon. And this is a problem, for example, for space-times that don't have an asymptotic infinity. So, and I'm going to try to write really, really big here. First drawback is that some space-times don't have an asymptotic boundary. Is this big enough for everyone to read? All right. So we don't have a way of defining the event horizon. An example of a spacetime like this is the closed recollapsing universe, which maybe I'll just draw it up here. You have this Big Bang singularity, and then a Big Crunch singularity. Here's the North Pole and the South Pole. Seems like a perfectly reasonable spacetime solution to Einstein's equations, but there's no asymptotic boundary, so we don't have a way of defining an event horizon. And even though we would like to have a way of talking about thermodynamics in the space-time, it's not clear how we're supposed to do that. Now, the second drawback, also rooted in the definition of the event horizon, is for space-times that do have an event horizon. The definition of the event horizon has an inherent acausality. Its location now, its area now, its properties now depend on what will happen 10 million years from now in the far-off future. The entropy of the black hole today depends on whether a star will fall into it in 10 million years. And given that we like to think about thermodynamics as something that depends on the present and depends on the past, but not so much on the future, this is a bit of a problem. This is called the event horizon teleology problem. Event horizon is teleological. And even though this isn't immediately a deal breaker, it would be really nice to have a formulation of black hole thermodynamics which is local in time. And this is where holographic screens come in. Holographic screens are surfaces that are defined in terms of the expansion of null duty 6, that is, the rate of change of an infinitesimal area element of a family of null duty 6. And so that is clearly a local quantity. And what's more, it has a special thermodynamic significance. Now, we proved that these holographic screens obey an area theorem. As you evolve along a holographic screen, you see the area of cross-sections increasing. And this already seems to indicate some special thermodynamic importance because we generally associate area laws as being thermodynamically significant. But it turns out that the connection goes deeper than that. The Busso bound tells us that these surfaces are independently important for thermodynamics. The areas of these cross-sections, they increase, we know that, thanks to our recent work. But back in 99, Rafael Busso also conjectured that the areas of a holographic screen give you a bound on the entropy of an entire slice of the space-time. And so we have multiple reasons to think that holographic screens are important for thermodynamics. And because they're local, they also, in some sense, address these two issues. Now, of course, nothing is perfect, and they do have problems of their own or really open questions, which I'll talk about at the end. So first, I'm going to talk about what holographic screens are. I'll give a definition, a few examples, and a construction. There's also some relation to prior work, like dynamical horizons and trapping horizons, so I'll talk about how those are related. Then I'm going to state our new area theorem, and I'll give a proof in the case of spherical symmetry. I'm not going to give the proof in the full gory detail. You can find it in the second paper here if you're interested. It's very involved and technical and not particularly illuminating once you've seen the spherically symmetric case. Maybe I'll say a couple of words about what those additional complications are and, roughly speaking, how we get around them. Then I'm going to talk about this generalized second law, the generalization of the area law for semi-classical regime. And this will involve going into a slight detour on the generalized entropy and quantum focusing. And finally, if I have time, I'll say a few words about the Busso bound, which is really an independent topic, but it reinforces the connection of thermodynamics. And if I still have time after that, I'm going to talk about some future directions and possibly some applications to ADS-CFT. But because I don't think I'll have time, I didn't even write it down. All right, so let me start. All graphic screens. So I said that these are defined in terms of the expansion of null geodesics. So let me just remind you what that looks like. Suppose we have some codimension 2 surface, and we have four ways of firing a null congruence off of that. We can fire a null congruence in the future inwards direction. We can fire one in the future outwards direction. We can fire it in the past inwards direction and the past outwards direction. And we have two future-directed null vectors. I'm just going to label them K and L because I'll be referring to them a lot. Now, the way I've drawn it, one of these expansions in the future is contracting. The area is getting progressively smaller as we evolve towards the future. And the other is expanding. This is what we normally expect. We fire a null congruence or fire light rays into a surface. They go in. We fire them outside. They go out. This is what's called a normal surface. And we can classify surfaces based on precisely how the sign of these expansions, whether they expand or converge. So I'm going to just jot down a table of all of these terms because I'll use them over and over again. There's a surface type, the expansion in the L direction, which is just one future direction, and the expansion in the K direction, the other future direction. So as I've said, a normal surface has negative expansion in one future direction and positive in the other future direction. Now, a trapped surface is, well, it's the sense in which it is trapped, so that you shed light out, it goes in. You shed light in, well, it still goes in. So this is one where the expansions are negative in both future directions. It's the kind of thing you might find deep inside a black hole or very close to a Big Crunch singularity. Similarly, we have anti-trapped, which is exactly what it sounds like. If you shine light out, it goes out. You fire light in, it still goes out. This is the kind of thing you might find near a Big Bang singularity or a white hole. And then we have the marginal cases, where a surface isn't really trapped and is not really normal. It's between the two, marginally trapped, where if you the inwards going null rays still converge. But the outgoing null rays, they neither converge nor expand. The expansion is zero. And similarly, we have marginally anti-trapped, which I'm just going to abbreviate because this is getting to be a mouthful, as MAT, where we have one direction in the future which is positive, and again, one which is zero. And finally, just for completeness, we have extremal surfaces, which have vanishing expansion in both directions. Now, I notice confused faces as to why I put the plus here and not there. And that's just a matter of convention. I'm going to want to always call the expansion that vanishes K. So I'm free to relabel these in whatever way I want, but just for future reference, I'm always going to say call the, if there's one expansion which is vanishing, I'm always going to call it K. So at this point, well, I should justify why am I talking about these things when I started talking about holographic screens. It turns out we can define holographic screens in terms of marginally trapped or marginally anti-trapped surfaces.
Can I slow you down for a second?
Yeah.
So the expansions are local things.
Yes.
So they can change as they move around on your surface. So you don't seem to want to consider those cases. You want to comment why?
So you mean I could start out with some expansion, which is, say, positive here and then negative somewhere else, something like that? Yeah, so that's none of these cases.
Right.
And I guess when I say local, I mean, I guess, really quasi-local, or it's local in time, but not local in space. So this definition of a trapped surface is local in time in the sense that you only need a single time slice or some small variations of a time slice to define it, but you do need the entire time slice. Yeah. So every time I say local, well, I really mean time local.
Are there rules on how crazy the surface can be? Like,
I mean, can we control it in some way? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. Can trap and anti-trap not live on the same?
If you have an asymptotic boundary and you're assuming, if you have an asymptotic boundary, then you can say, well, if I have a trapped surface and I shoot a light ray from it, it can't reach the asymptotic boundary. You can get a contradiction if it does that. Whereas if I have an anti-trapped surface, well, it can't reach past infinity. So future light shot outwards from a trapped surface can't reach future infinity, and light shot outwards towards the past from an anti-trapped surface, it can't reach past infinity. So that to give you some constraints, but you might be able to cook up some pathological situation where you have a surface which is partially in different kinds of horizons. I wouldn't be surprised if you could do that. Yeah. So we can define different kinds of holographic screens depending on whether we use marginally trapped or marginally anti-trapped surfaces. Let me write down the definition. A future holographic screen is a codimension one surface. Can everybody read this? Foliated by marginally trapped surfaces, which again I'm going to abbreviate because it's going to take too long to write, and I'm going to call these leaves. And similarly, a past holographic screen is defined in terms of marginally anti-trapped surfaces. And at this point, you could hopefully start to see why we can think of these as time-local black hole boundaries. If we think of the interior of the black hole as the region that contains trapped surfaces, and the exterior of the black hole as a region that contains normal surfaces, then it stands to reason that the boundary would be one consisting of marginally trapped surfaces. And that's the sense in which we can think of future holographic screens as time-local black hole boundaries. And we can think of past holographic screens as something more like time-local cosmological horizons. Sorry, what was that?
Is an apparent horizon the same thing as a future holographic
screen? So I'm going
screen?
To say a few words about the apparent horizon right after I give a few examples of the holographic screens, yeah. So let me give an example of holographic screens which is simple and easy to understand, but also a little bit misleading. So I think it's interesting enough that it's better to put it in as an example than not, even though it's a little misleading. So I'm just going to consider the Schwarzschild black hole. The event horizon. Now, out here in this asymptotic region, we have normal surfaces. And same thing for this asymptotic region here. Near the black hole singularity, we have trapped surfaces. And here near the white hole singularity, we have anti-trapped surfaces. And so we have multiple holographic screens in this picture. The boundary between normal and anti-trapped is a past holographic screen. So there's one on the event horizon itself. Then we have this boundary between normal and trapped and anti-trapped, which is again another past holographic screen. We have the boundary between normal and trapped, which is a future holographic screen. And I'm out of color, so I'm going to use white for the last one. This boundary between trapped and normal is another future holographic screen. And this surface here, the bifurcation surface, is an extremal surface. So we have four holographic screens here, all of which lie on different portions of the event horizons. Now, the reason that this is misleading is it might look like they always lie on the event horizon, but that is actually very special. Generically, the event horizon and holographic screen will not coincide. One can asymptote to the other, but they will not agree. So that's the sense in which this is a little bit misleading. So let me give you a couple of examples that are more generic than this. Like, say, collapsing star, an Oppenheimer-Schneider geometry. So the singularity. This is the collapsing star. And here's the event horizon. And in this example, if you just work it out, you find that the holographic screen looks something like this. It's time-like inside the shell, or inside the star, and then becomes space-like, asymptoting to null along the event horizon outside of the star. And this is a future holographic screen. And the direction along which the cross-sections of this have vanishing expansion is this one right here. This is a zero expansion. And this direction is the negative expansion. It's foliated by marginally trapped surfaces. An example of a past holographic screen, say a matter-dominated FRW cosmology. So here's my Big Bang singularity. And the holographic screen is time-like, and it looks something like this, where these marginally trapped surfaces have vanishing expansion in this direction and negative expansion in this direction. Are there any questions at this point? OK, so I kind of pulled these out of a hat. I didn't show you where I found them or how I got them. And one very nice construction that's in Rafael Busso's 99 paper, just give it a space-time and you can get these. And the idea is you start it with your space-time and you foliate it into null surfaces, null slices. So if I'm looking at this picture here, you know, foliated out here and I'm foliating it in here by these null surfaces. And then you travel along each null surface until you reach a surface of vanishing expansion. So I'm starting here, and I reach this, and this is a surface of vanishing expansion. And then you take the union across all of these surfaces of vanishing expansion, and that gives you a holographic screen. So this is, for example, the null foliation here that corresponds to this holographic screen. And I can show you a similar one here. I can foliate this into these null surfaces. And each intersection here is going to be a marginally anti-trapped surface. This is one construction. There are others. You can consider the light cones of an observer. These will be observer-dependent, and so on. Now, there was a question about an apparent horizon, so I want to talk a little bit about some prior work. We're not exactly the first to try to use marginally trapped surfaces to define a local or time-local notion of a black hole boundary. We can use this, though people have used them in the past, and in particular, the earliest attempt was the apparent horizon, which is defined in the following way. You foliate your spacetime into Cauchy surfaces, and then on each Cauchy surface, you take the union of all trapped surfaces, and you take the boundary of that. And that's the apparent horizon on that Cauchy slice, and you take the union of all of those across your Cauchy foliation. And there's a possibility that this obeys an area law, but the apparent horizon can jump. It's not necessarily continuous. So that's a little bit problematic. But also, it's difficult to see that it would have an area law, namely because you can take any Cauchy surface and you can sort of fold it up like a fan. And then it seems that doing this, you can shrink the area of any slice of the apparent horizon in any way you want. So maybe an area law exists. I don't know of any counterexamples. But it's not obvious or easy to see how you'd go about proving it. Proving that there's an area law. Now there are,
So you can prove that there is an area law that's increasing in an ADS-CFT context, provided that you have enough symmetry. So something like imposing spherical symmetry,
mm-hmm.
or in case of a brain-like geometry, translational invariance. So indeed, in that case, you can rigorously show that an apparent horizon defined in a way. And it's also actually related to the fact that if you look at you can relate to hydrodynamics as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the growth of the apparent horizon, at least for slow dynamics, corresponds, the positivity of that corresponds to positivity of the bulk viscosity.
Yeah.
So there is a relation there, and so there is something that can be.
Yeah, I certainly, in the case we have a lot of symmetries, the apparent horizon, I certainly can believe that it would obey an area law. Also, in the case where there are a lot of symmetries, it often coincides with holographic screens,
right.
Where we have proven an area, where we have proved area law.
Yeah.
So, but it's not clear how to do it in broad generality, where you can allow any kind of you don't restrict yourself to any symmetries or anything. It's not obvious how to do that. Yeah. Now there are other notions of local black hole boundaries which can sort of be thought of as more restricted precursors to holographic screen. And if I write on over here, everybody can read it. So these are the dynamical horizons or future outwards trapping horizons. Future outwards trapping horizons. These were defined by Ashtakar and Krishnan, and they studied them in a series of papers from 02 to 05. And these were defined by Sean Hayward in 93. These are more or less the same thing when you impose a generic condition. And essentially, these are space-like future holographic screens. So in this picture of Oppenheimer-Schneider, this bit right here is a dynamical horizon. Now, one really nice thing about these is that they were able to prove an area law that the area of dynamical horizons increases as you evolve outwards along the horizon. So if you start here and you evolve in this way, there is an area law. You will see the area of these leaves constantly increasing. Now, they also define something called time-like membranes, which, as you might be guessing now, are just time-like future holographic screens. And these also obey an area law, but it's a strange area law. It's an area law that tells you that the area increases as you evolve backwards in time. So this here is a time-like membrane, and the area increases. You see the area increasing of these marginally trapped surfaces, these leaves, as you evolve in this direction. Now, this is strange, but I'll say a little bit more about it later. Now, but you look at this here, and you might say, okay, well, this is kind of bizarre. As you evolve in this way, and you keep on evolving this way, you see the area just increasing continuously. And you might ask, is there some sort of a conspiracy that these pieces always stitch themselves together, the time-like and the space-like piece, in such a way that the area increases on holographic screens regardless of what their signature is, always? And as you, again, might guess by the title of my talk, the answer is yes, and that is the area law that we prove. And before I go on to section two, I want to say one quick thing, which is that these are defined for future holographic screens. If you change future to past, so we're dealing with marginally anti-trapped surfaces, then the directions of increase change, they just reverse directions. So the area will be increasing towards the future on a past holographic screen in this direction, and it'll be increasing inwards if it's a space-like past holographic screen. Okay, so now let me go on to talk about the area theorem. Now I'm going to be a good physicist and state my assumptions before I start stating my theorem. I'm going to start out with, I'm not going to state all my assumptions, actually, because some of them are technical and not particularly illuminating, and some of them are obvious, like global hyperbolicity, which I'm not even going to write down. But there are a couple which are important for the spherically symmetric proof, so I'm going to jot those down. The first is the null curvature condition, which is essentially just a statement of the null energy condition when your space-time obeys Einstein's equations. It's the statement that if you contract the Ricci tensor twice with any null vector in your space-time, this quantity is greater than or equal to zero. This is a very reasonable condition to assume for classical matter. It's not so reasonable for quantum matter, and when I get to this third section here, I'll say some words about that. The second condition is a sort of generic condition. It's not the same generic condition as the one that we have for the singularity theorems. If you open Wald and you read those, it's a slightly different generic condition, stronger in some ways and weaker in others. It's the statement that for the vector k, the special vector k, which is the one with the vanishing expansion, the one that's this right here, for that special vector, the expansion in that direction, is the derivative of the expansion, is strictly greater than zero on the holographic screen. And I'll say what that means in a second. Essentially, what this means is that if we start out on the holographic screen and we take one of these leaves and we evolve off the holographic screen slightly along the direction of this null K congruence, then the expansion goes from zero on the marginal trapped surface to become immediately negative as we evolve off the holographic screen. Now, the usual generic condition that we see in the singularity theorems will tell you that actually the expansion will become negative before it reaches future infinity, but it won't necessarily become negative immediately. That's the sense in which this is a stronger condition than the generic condition of the singularity theorems. It's also weaker because we only require this of one vector, and we only require it on the holographic screen, whereas the generic condition applies to all null vectors in the space-time. So a little weaker, a little stronger. We have to assume it, so.
So can you translate this second condition into some sort of condition on a stress energy tensor or something that just parts of the Solving-Einstein equation? What's that?
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially what we really want is the Rache-Dury equation to tell us, together with the null energy condition. Normally, it will tell us that this is true with the equality sign.
And null energy condition, effectively.
I'm sorry?
It's effectively null energy
condition. Well, it's not exactly the same thing, because the null energy condition will tell us this with the Rache-Dury equation. It's not going to be a strict inequality. We're saying this is generic. This generic condition is when this inequality is strict. So I guess if you wanted to say, if you wanted this to be some kind of a new null energy condition, that would be sufficient. Either one of the two.
By new, you mean different?
A slightly stronger null energy condition.
So what slightly, can I rephrase it, not in terms of geometry, but in terms of matter?
Yeah, if you assume your space-time obeys Einstein's equations,
yes,
then it can be just the null energy condition. But stronger in the sense that instead of TAB, KAKB greater than or equal to zero, it's TAB, KAKB greater than zero for this particular vector K, not for anything else. Sorry, what was that?
So your holographic screens,
the holographic screens are not generally null. Generically, they will not be null.
Okay, but I presume that.
Oh, when I say on the holographic screen,
yeah,
I mean that we start on the holographic screen and we evolve slightly off it. I don't mean that you can take this vector k anywhere in the space-time and then evolve from there. I'm saying this only holds when you evolve off of the holographic screen. When you start on the holographic screen and evolve away from it. Okay, so earlier I mentioned that space-like holographic screens obey an area law, and so do time-like holographic screens. And you're a very generous audience and kind of just took my word for it. But I want to convince you this is true, also because it kind of ties into our general proof. Now, the original proof was due to Ashtekar and Krishnan, but it's a very different line of formalism from what we used. So I'm going to actually present the proof that we had for this, even though credit should be given to the people who did it first. So I'm going to do this in two separate cases, first the space-like case, and then the time-like case. So let me consider the space-like case first. So I have some space-like holographic screen, and I'm going to take two leaves on this holographic screen that are very close to one another. So this is my, say, sigma 1, and this is sigma 2. And if I were to draw this in 3D, this would be sigma 1, and this would be sigma 2. OK, and I can shoot out the L congruence, along which the expansion is negative, and the K congruence, along which the expansion is 0, from both of these. So here's the K congruence and the L congruence, this L congruence and this K congruence. Now, I have this intersection here, which I'm going to call sigma tilde. And over here, it's going to look something like this. Sorry about the drawing. I'm not an artist. OK, and this surface here is sigma tilde. It's just the idea. It's just the intersection between these two null congruences. OK, well, I know that the expansion theta k, which is, just remind you, 1 over a dA d lambda, where A is the cross-sectional area of the congruence, this is equal to 0 at sigma 1 by definition of a leaf. Now, if these two leaves are sufficiently close to one another, then evolving along this k-congruence will not change the area of sigma tilde. That's just calculus. So the area of sigma 1 is going to equal the area of sigma tilde. Now I can evolve backwards from sigma tilde to sigma 2. The expansion is negative in the L direction towards the future, but then it's positive towards the past. And so this tells me that the area increases as I evolve in this direction. So the area of sigma 2 is greater than the area of sigma tilde. And voila, I have an area law. The area of sigma 2 is greater than the area of sigma 1. And so what this tells us is that as we evolve along a holographic, a space-like holographic screen, in the direction which is the k-vector projected onto the screen, then the area increases along the screen. Now, the timeline case is very similar. Just quickly go through it. We have some timeline holographic screen, and we have two leaves that are very close to one another. And again, we can shoot the L congruence and the K congruence. Of course, in this case, they don't intersect the same way they did there. We have to extend them further. Now, because the expansion here is strictly negative, if I take these two leaves to be sufficiently close to one another, it's still going to be negative over here on sigma tilde. And so now I can do exactly the same thing I did before. I can evolve sigma 2 to sigma tilde along the k-congruence, where the area will not change. So the area of sigma 2 equals the area of sigma tilde. Then I evolve from sigma tilde here to sigma 1. But now I'm evolving towards the future, where the expansion is strictly negative. And so the area will be decreasing as I evolve in this way, so that the area of sigma tilde will be greater than the area of sigma 1. And here is the area law for the timeline case. The area increases as we evolve towards the past. Any questions at this point? OK, great. So now I want to put these two together. And at this point, I hope it's somewhat clear how to do that. We have we have this space-like case, and we have this timeline case. And the main thing we need to do to get a mixed signature case is to make sure that if we evolve along the screen in the direction of increasing area, we don't run into some kind of a traffic accident. So let me draw the bad scenarios and the good scenarios, the ones we want to rule out versus the ones that we want to actually have. So suppose that you're traveling along a holographic screen, which is space-like, and the area is increasing. And all of a sudden, the holographic screen becomes future-directed. So now the area is increasing in this direction. So area increases here, and area increases here, and we have the dreaded collision scenario. So this is a bad transition, something we want to rule out. Now, if the area is increasing in this direction, this means that the vector k, which is the one that projects onto the screen in the direction of increasing area, is this one right here, just to ground you in terms of what it looks like in that picture. Now, a similarly bad transition is the one where we have the reverse of a traffic accident. So we're evolving towards the future here, and the area is decreasing. And then we start evolving towards the exterior, and all of a sudden, the area is increasing. So here, the area increases in this direction. And this is the k vector. And here, the area is increasing in this direction. So these are both things that we want to rule out. Versus the good transitions, not the god transitions. The good transitions are something like, oh, we're evolving towards the past, and then we're evolving outside. So the area is consistently increasing. Or we're evolving towards the outside, and then we're evolving towards the past. So the area, again, is consistently increasing. So I want to rule out these two situations. And you'll notice that what they have in common is that they both have a point or surface where they're tangent to the vector k. And so the bad things are when the entire holographic screen has a point where it's tangent to the vector k. That's what we want to rule out. And that's the idea behind the proof of the theorem. So let me now give a proof. Well, let me state the theorem first, and then give a proof in the case of spherical symmetry. So the theorem, the area theorem, is a statement that the area of leaves of a holographic screen, well, either future or past, but not the union of the two, increases monotonically with continuous flow along the screen. Okay, so now let me give you a proof in the case of spherical symmetry, which is very nice and very simple. This is, I guess, mini proof. Okay, so I said before the bads, the transitions we want to rule out are the ones that are tangent to K. So let me just draw them over here. It's this situation right here. Let me draw it over here. I can draw bigger. Okay, so these are the bad transitions. This one right here, where it's tangent to the vector K, and this one right here, where it's also tangent to the vector K. Okay, so the idea behind the proof is the following. We have here, by construction, some leaf, call it sigma 1, and sigma 1. And because this screen is tangent to the vector K, we can shoot a null congruence backwards in the K direction so that it will hit the screen again because of this tangency. Similar thing here. Now, by spherical symmetry, this intersection here is a complete leaf, sigma 2. By definition, the expansion of a leaf vanishes in the k direction. So it's 0 here. So theta k of sigma 2 is equal to 0. And again, by definition, theta k of sigma 1 is also equal to 0. Now let me call this congruence here n. Because of by the Ricci-Dour equation and null energy condition, we know that this means that theta k of n on this entire stretch must be strictly 0. Now, but the generic condition tells us that as soon as we evolve slightly off of the screen, the expansion must become negative. And so that gives us a contradiction and a proof in the spherically symmetric case. You can say, well, that was pretty simple. What goes so badly wrong when you're looking at the non-spherically symmetric case? And there are two things that make our life very, very complicated. The first one is that we're not guaranteed that this intersection is actually a leaf when you get rid of spherical symmetry. The second is that we're not guaranteed that there actually is a leaf in any one of these constant signature regions. We could have one of these marginally trapped surfaces start in the space-like region, go through the null transition region, and end up somewhere in the time-like part. And that makes comparisons like this very difficult. So roughly speaking, the way we deal with it is we have to make an extra assumption. We have to assume that the space-like piece right here actually contains a complete leaf. And I guess let me just show you how it works in this case. If the space-like piece contains a complete leaf, so this sigma 1 over here, then we can evolve along the screen until we reach the last leaf. Let's call sigma 0. The last leaf that contains absolutely no intersection with the time-like portion. It can intersect the null transition region, but not the time-like portion. And then we evolve just a little bit further up to a leaf that, by construction, has an intersection with the time-like region. And then we can shoot this null congruence down here. And through a series of painful and agonizing results, we can actually show that this intersection exists and that it lies entirely to the past of some leaf sigma sub r. Using this and using the theorem of Aaron-Walz from 2010, finally we can get a contradiction. And that gives us the proof in full generality without spherical symmetry, assuming the null energy condition. So nobody has any questions. I'm going to conclude the classical portion of this talk and move on to semi-classical gravity. Right. Okay, so generalized second law. Okay, so in this proof, in this place right here where we got this contradiction over here, we had to assume the null energy condition. And this is a very reasonable condition for classical GR. Hawking assumed it for his area theorem for event horizons. But it's not such a reasonable condition once we start adding quantum effects in. Fairly reasonable constructions can violate the null energy condition. For example, Hawking radiation, an evaporating black hole, here's this collapsing matter, this will violate the null energy condition near the event horizon, which also means that the Hawking area theorem is violated. If we start out in this region here, this is a collapsing phase, the event horizon area grows. And over here in the evaporation phase, the event horizon area shrinks. So we have a violation of the Hawking area theorem. Now you might say, well, does that mean that there's a violation of our area theorem for holographic screens? Sure, the null energy condition is violated, but maybe we didn't really need it when we proved the area theorem. Maybe there's another way to prove it. But it turns out that actually this evaporating black hole also violates our area theorem. A holographic screen in this kind of picture looks something like this. So due to these quantum effects, it can actually exit the event horizon. And you can see here, if we have some null surface, sorry, some water. If we have this null surface there, the holographic screen intersects it at two surfaces here. This was where we got the contradiction in this case over here. But of course, this required the null energy condition. So that is, we're not assuming that anymore. This doesn't give us a contradiction. What it does give us is a violation of the area theorem. Over here in the collapse phase, the areas of the holographic screen grow. And over here, you see they're right next to the event horizon, which is shrinking. And so by continuity, you can see that the areas will be shrinking and growing in different places. And therefore, we have a violation of the holographic screen area theorem as well. Now, historically, Bekenstein said, OK, let's forget about area. Let's replace it by the generalized entropy. This was Bekenstein's idea, which I like to think of as some kind of a quantum corrected area. Now, quantum corrected area is kind of a whimsical term, so let me define it a little bit more precisely. And I'm not erasing this because of strategic reasons. So the generalized entropy, as I've mentioned before, is defined as the area of a 4GH bar plus the entanglement entropy outside the black hole. So more precisely, if we have some Cauchy surface, sigma, and we have some surface on sigma, it's called little sigma, which divides sigma into two pieces, this interior and exterior, then we define the generalized entropy of sigma as the area of sigma over 4GH bar plus the entanglement entropy of the exterior of sigma. So this is the von Neumann entropy, rho out log rho out, where rho out is the reduced density matrix of the exterior of sigma. Now, this might look divergent, I guess. If you're looking at this, this entanglement entropy has all these divergences. But there's been a lot of work, and there's a lot of evidence showing that the divergences of this may actually be absorbed into the renormalization of Newton's constant. There's a lot of people who worked on this. Forsyev, Frolov, Solodukin, Wall, Donnelly, I'm probably missing some 20 others. But there's a lot of good evidence showing that this is the case. So I'm just going to treat it as if this quantity is finite, which is what the evidence at this point suggests. Although we don't know this is true in all cases. Okay, so Bekenstein suggested that we take the area of a 4GH bar and replace it by the generalized entropy. And he said this generalized entropy should be increasing along the event horizon, even in this evaporating black hole case, because of entanglement. And this generalized second law is not proven. Bekenstein's generalized second law isn't proven in broad generality, but proofs do exist in all kinds of limiting regimes, like supernormalizable theories and free field theories, thanks to Aaron Wall. And this kind of substitution has proven to be very useful in taking classical results and generalizing them to semi-classical gravity. And that's pretty much exactly what we're going to do. But we have to work a little bit harder than Bekenstein did, because Bekenstein could just take the area theorem and say, OK, area is going to go to generalized entropy. And so because the area only appears once in the area theorem, the area increases, and that's all, then that's all that had to be done. But in our theorem, the area appears twice in the definition of the holographic screen, because the area of marginally trapped surfaces decreases along the congruences, and also in the statement of the theorem, that the area increases along the screen. And so this means making this substitution actually means that we have to change the definition of a holographic screen to a quantum-corrected holographic screen, where we don't take derivatives of areas to define the marginally trapped surfaces, but instead we take derivatives of the generalized entropy. And so this means defining something like quantum marginally trapped surface, which was first done by Aaron Wall in 2010 and formalized by Busso, Fischer, Leichenauer, and Wall just this past summer. So let me write down the definition and then define what I exactly mean by a Q-screen, quantum-corrected screen, because Q-screen, quantum-corrected screen is a real mouthful. OK, so the main complication here is that the generalized entropy is non-local. So we can't just take derivatives of infinitesimal regions. We have to vary it with respect to an entire slice, because the generalized entropy is defined on an entire surface like this. And this just means that we have to look at a slightly different formalism, which is what was done by Busso, Fischer, Leichenauer, and Wall. The idea is this. You start out with the surface sigma, and we consider some null congruence of it. This is sigma. Now, any point along the null congruence can be labeled by two things. It can be labeled by the point that it is mapped to on sigma when you evolve it backwards along this null congruence. I'll call this point y and this point p. And also the amount of affine parameter that we had to evolve in order to go from y to p. And so p can be qualified by the point y and the affine parameter lambda along the null congruence, which means that we can actually write down an entire slice of this null congruence by just taking a function of y equals lambda. So we say, OK, we have some function of the point y, and it tells us how much to evolve each one of them. And that gives us a slice of the null congruence. Using this, we can take variations of the generalized entropy with respect to a slice, with respect to this function v of y. So let me now define this, say quantum marginally trapped surface. Now, quantum might be a little bit misleading, like we're doing non-perturbative quantum gravity or something. Really, we mean semi-classical. So here, which I left up, we have this marginally trapped. Theta L is negative and theta K is 0, which means that we take the derivative of dA, of the area, with respect to this L congruence, it'll be negative, and with respect to the K congruence, it'll vanish. Now we're just going to do the same thing with functional derivatives. So the functional derivative of the generalized entropy along the slices of the L congruence is going to be strictly negative. And the functional derivative of the generalized entropy with respect to the K congruence is going to be precisely 0. This defines a quantum marginally trapped surface, and that's Busso, Fischer, Leichenauer, and Wall. From 2015. Okay, so now I can use these, quantum marginally anti-trapped just has the opposite inequality here. So now I can finally define a Q screen. Erase this right here. As a surface which is foliated by these quantum marginally trapped surfaces. So a future Q screen is a codimension one surface foliated by quantum marginally trapped surfaces. And I abbreviated marginally trapped surfaces, so you can't expect me to write down quantum marginally trapped. And similarly, a past Q screen is foliated by quantum marginally anti-trapped surfaces. Okay, so now we can actually write down a generalized second law for these Q screens, and it's very much the same as the area law. The generalized entropy of these quantum marginally trapped surfaces along a holographic screen increases monotonically with continuous flow along the screen. And I will write that down. So our new generalized second law is a statement that S gen of leaves of a Q screen increases monotonically along the holographic screen, along the Q screen. Now, we can't prove it in broad generality, just like Bekenstein couldn't prove his general second law in broad generality. To do that, we would need something like a quantum focusing theorem. And these guys have a conjecture, it's called the quantum focusing conjecture, that such a thing exists, but it's only proven in certain limiting regimes. If we assume this, then we do have a proof of this generalized second law, that it is true whenever the quantum focusing conjecture is true, which is proven for free in super normalizable field theories. Okay, so I've told you a lot of things. What is the upshot of this generalized second law? Well, for one, we now have a local generalized second law, which doesn't depend on the asymptotic boundary, so it applies in spacetimes that have no asymptotic boundary. We don't need the asymptotic boundary to determine what is this generalized entropy or what the thermodynamics might be. And in particular, in spacetimes like expanding cosmologies, like the one that we see around us, well, in that case, it agrees with our intuition. The generalized entropy increases towards the future. But it gets a little confusing when we look at black holes. If you look at the null collapse, at null dust or something, then the holographic screen is space-like. And it's not clear what does it mean that the generalized entropy increases in a space-like direction. What is that? Is that something physical? Is there some notion of thermodynamic error which is associated with that? It's not clear. But it's even more confusing when we're looking at things like time-like collapse. So here, the Q screen, this is the classical holographic screen. The Q screen looks something like this. And it's time-like inside the star. So just like the classical holographic screen was also time-like inside the star in Oppenheimer-Schneider collapse. So now it looks like the generalized entropy is increasing towards the past. And that has had the unfortunate side effect of a number of popular science journalists writing articles, "Physicists discover time runs backwards inside black holes," which was not really the intention of our article. But it does raise the question of, well, if we want to associate some meaning to the generalized entropy, some thermodynamic meaning, what does it mean that it's running backwards? And you know, at this point, we're not really sure why it's doing that and what is the thermodynamic significance of that. While I'm on the subject of thermodynamic significance, I want to say a few words about the Busseau bound, which is another way of looking at holographic screens and understanding what they mean thermodynamically. So now I'm short on time, but I'm just going to say a few words. Okay, so recall the picture that I drew earlier, which looked something like this. With all of the null congruences from a codimension two surface. Now, we have these four congruences, and generally two of them will be shrinking away from the surface. So in this case, this congruence is shrinking away from the surface, and this congruence is also shrinking away from the surface. Congruences that do that are called light sheets. So if this is a surface sigma, then a light sheet of sigma is a null congruence which shrinks away from sigma. Now, the Busseau bound is a statement that the area of sigma is a bound on the entropy that is on the light sheet L. So this is the statement that this is the Busseau bound 39, the statement that the entropy of the light sheet L is less than or equal to the area of sigma over 4G H bar. And this was proven in the hydrodynamic regime by Flanagan, Meroff-Wald, and also Busso-Flanagan, Meroff-Wald. And there's a quantum generalization by Busso, Cassini, Fisher, and Maldacena. Now, if we have more than one light sheet, more than two light sheets on sigma, any surface will have two. But if we have more than two, then we can get an additional, we can get extra bounds. So when we have quantum marginally, we have, sorry, marginally trapped surfaces, then the expansion is going to be zero in one direction towards the future, which means it's also zero in that direction towards the past, which means that the area is going to be shrinking away from the surface along an entire null slice of the space-time. So in the Oppenheimer-Schneider geometry, this looks something like this. All right. Sorry about the drawing. So if this is the holographic screen, then, and this is some surface sigma here, which is a marginally trapped surface, then this is a light sheet, and this is a light sheet, and this is also a light sheet. So if we just ignore this one for a second and just look at these two, then we have a bound on the, this is an entire null slice of the space-time, and if we have the area of this gives a bound on this, and it gives a bound on that, then it also gives a bound on the two of them together. The area of this is, the area of this is the 2G H bar, gives us a bound on the entropy of this entire null slice. And at this point, it actually makes sense why the area increases as we evolve towards the past. Because as we evolve towards the past, we recover more and more away from the singularity. We get, these slices get progressively larger. So from the perspective of the Busso bound, it makes sense that things are going to be increasing in this direction. Now, these holographic screens are, of course, very special because this their cross-sections give us bounds on the entropy of an entire slice of the space-time. And it's interesting from this perspective, but it still doesn't explain what it means for the area to be decreasing in this direction, or more generally, for the generalized entropy to be decreasing in this direction away from the picture of the Busso bound. So in the last couple of minutes that I have, I want to just talk a little bit about future directions and summarize what I did. What we did. These are really open questions. So first of all, there's this issue of this backwards directed arrow of thermodynamic time, whatever you want to call it. So this, what is going on inside the black holes with these holographic screens? So backwards entropy flow. The other question is something that I glossed over a little bit in the talk, which is the fact that holographic screens are observer-dependent, which makes them non-unique. So a given space-time, we'll have a lot of holographic screens. And sure, there are a lot of indications that these are very important thermodynamically. But well, what does it mean that they're important thermodynamically, but they are, there are a lot of them? Which one actually contains information about the entropy? It's not clear if we can extract something that is true about all of them, some quantity, which all of them have, but just from one of them, because they are non-unique. So what is this question of non-uniqueness, and what does it mean that we have this degeneracy?
Okay, so are you observer-dependent in your holographic screen?
Yeah, all of these holographic screens are observer-dependent, because if you think we construct them by starting with a null foliation. If we picked a different null foliation, we'd get a different screen. Or alternatively, you can construct them off of the light cones of an observer. If you pick a different observer, you get different light cones, you get a different holographic screen. So unlike the event horizon, which is unique, the holographic screens are not unique. It's the kind of the price you pay for things being local, that they're going to be observer dependent in this case. Now, the final question is the applications to ADS-CFT. In ADS-CFT, event horizons are special. The stationary event horizons are special. Extremal surfaces, which are dual to entanglement entropy, they have problems with stationary event horizons. They can't cross stationary event horizons. This is a result that was originally Veronica Hubany for static black holes, and then Aaron Wall and I generalized it to stationary black holes. However, when you go to a dynamical setup, the event horizon ceases to be important completely. The event horizon is just, the extremal surfaces just plow right through it. And so Well, it makes sense because the event horizon isn't something which is important on a local level. It's important globally, and extremal surfaces are sensitive to local behavior. Well, you might ask, are holographic screens then the barriers to extremal surfaces in ADS-CFT? Because they seem to replace black holes, replace black hole event horizons with something that's more local. And the answer is kind of yes and no. They're not really barriers, but they act as they constrain the behavior of extremal surfaces. It ends up being the case that if an extremal surface goes into a holographic screen, its behavior is constrained in such a way that the only real prescription we have for reconstructing the bulk is it doesn't really work. It works a little bit. It gives us some part of the space-time, but not all of it. And we have this, and generically, it will never give us all of it. So these look like they are barriers to holographic reconstruction, but it's not clear. It's not clear exactly in what way. It's a little bit subtle. So okay, with that, let me just wrap up. I showed you a new area theorem. Hopefully, I convinced you it's true with the proof of spherical symmetry. And I also explained a generalized second law, the generalization to semi-classical gravity. There are a number of open questions. You know, we closed some questions. We said, here's an alternative that doesn't depend on the asymptotic boundary. It has a nice property that event horizons have, which is that the area increases. But it's also not unique, and it has this strange backwards entropy flow. So there's hopefully a lot more progress to be made in this, and we do have some work in progress, especially on this last point over here. Thank you.
Are there any conditions you could impose on holographic screens to make them unique?
To make them unique.
Anything else you could add?
Well, if you can, I'd be glad to hear it. I don't know of any myself, simply because they really depend on this null foliation, which is, it's like the apparent horizon is defined using a Cauchy foliation. How do you define an apparent horizon without using a Cauchy foliation? I think the only example that I know of, actually, the only construction I know of actually reduces to that of the event horizon, which is teleological. Example of what, sorry?
Can you get temperature to look at the screens?
Sorry, I'm not sure you understand the question.
The horizon of black hole has a temperature of the radiation. Is there anything like that for people?
Oh, you mean like a first law type of thing? Or so that's something that is currently work in progress. Now, in general black hole thermodynamics, we don't have a first law usually. We need a definition of surface gravity, which, as far as I'm aware, in current progress, we only have it in the case of stationary black holes. So in the case of stationary black holes, holographic screens are kind of trivial. They just lie on the event horizon, and we can use it in the same way. I think there's been some recent work, which is currently in progress, on trying to generalize that into something which is more dynamical for holographic screens in general, but I don't think there are any concrete results yet. Yeah.
You were mentioning it, so maybe. So my question is related to this generalized entropy, and I'm thinking about the very simple black hole, the one with static horizons in ADS.
Okay, right? Like Schwarzschild ADS.
Yeah, you can think of it, or maybe some scaling stuff. So what's when I do the computation, I put h bar equal to 1, right? So the first piece, the classical piece, is, and I. Again, on the holographic screen, as you just said, it's just a event horizon.
In that case, yeah.
Right, in that case. So what's the contribution of this additional piece? Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, it's why it should be zero. Basically, what I'm saying is that what is a classical limit? How is a generalized entropy get reduced to the standard Bekenstein entropy?
Well, in the case where you don't have quantum fields on your spacetime, then,
but I mean a holography. I mean ADS-CFT.
Sure, you can. You can
well
be
what
sure.
Is an entropy?
Sure, you. I mean, you can.
It satisfies first law in a quite non-trivial settings. But then there is this additional correction, which I also I think know how to compute. I can use Rudolph-Yanagi.
Well, yes, but something to. But the problem is that the generalized entropy is the generalized entropy in the bulk. So the Ryutaka-Yanagi conjecture or formula, it tells us that the area in the bulk is equal to the entanglement entropy on the boundary. Now I'm talking about the generalized entropy in the bulk, which includes bulk entanglement. So that this is only non-trivial whenever the bulk itself is partially quantum. So that if you have quantum fields living in your bulk spacetime, then you're going to have non-vanishing entanglement in your spacetime. And then you're going to have contributions to the entanglement and to the generalized entropy. But as soon as you're in the classical limit, the entanglement entropy reduces to the area.
I see. So that other piece is just the bulk entanglement.
Yes, it's the bulk entanglement. If you want to do this in a DSCFT, it's the bulk entanglement. Yeah.
Probably be the fine question. So in this setup where people use to connect hydrodynamics and general relativity, essentially small fluctuations around the static black hole, I guess. In this setup, could you perhaps try to understand how the holographic screens look like? Well, I mean, you said it when the things are static, they sit on the horizon.
Yeah.
Things are just a little bit dynamical.
Yeah, you can understand what holographic screens look like in classical GR in any setting you want.
Want to find an interpretation in the fluid dynamic.
Oh, so I think you could probably do it in that case. Yeah, but the issue is more defining surface gravity in the dynamical case. We can define a holographic screen in the general dynamical case, but it's not clear how we should be defining the surface gravity for those things. So maybe in the hydrodynamic regime, there might be a way of extrapolating from the static case. But I guess I don't know. I can't think of anything immediately on the spot. Yeah.
Well, one thing is that maybe that's what you had in mind. I don't know what you had in mind. But one thing is that when you are close to equilibrium, say, in a hydrodynamic regime, so there are some concepts of entropy.
Yes.
In principle, entropy of equilibrium is not well defined. And I think in this particular context, we more or less quite well understand how to define the entropy.
And
temperature is less because temperature is equilibrium concept. So temperature, I don't want to define temperature, but the entropy is something that.
You mean like some kind of an entropy flux?
Yes. So the questions that could be asked is that this kind of entropy that you define on a holographic screen, how is that related to the off equilibrium entropy in the situation
where it's the hydrodynamic regime? I'm not sure. We don't ever write area of the. We don't ever write that this quantity in the holographic screen actually equals the entropy. The Bussel bound does have a proof in the hydrodynamic regime, so it certainly is a bound on the entropy. I don't think that we can say that it actually is equal to any particular kind of entropy, because at this point, it's just an area law.
But that's related to the earlier observations that you said, that it's not observer defined. So maybe trying to see in which case it really agrees with the hydrodynamic entropy, it would pick up some particular observer. But that's
a good point. Thank you. Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, thank you again.